If you have your Bibles with you, I would invite you to take them and to turn with me to Acts chapter 12. And we'll read verses 1 to 17 together this morning. Acts 12, 1 to 17. As we continue to explore the topic of prayer. Let's stand as we read together. Now about that time, Herod the king laid hands on some who belonged to the church in order to mistreat them. And he had James, the brother of John, put to death with a sword. When he saw that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. Now it was during the days of unleavened bread. When he had seized him, he put him in prison, delivering him to four squads of soldiers to guard him, intending after the Passover to bring him out before the people. So Peter was kept in prison, but prayer for him was being made fervently by the church to God. On the very night when Herod was about to bring him forward, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains, and guards in front of the door were watching over the prison. And behold, an angel suddenly appeared, and light shone in the cell, and he struck Peter's side and woke him up, saying, "Get up quickly," and his chains fell off his hands. And the angel said to himself, "Gird yourself and put on your sandals." And he did so. And he said to him, "Wrap your cloak around you and follow me." And he went out and continued to follow. And he did not know that what was being done was by an angel was real, but thought he was seeing a vision. When they had passed the first and second guard, they came to the iron gate that leads into the city, which opened for them by itself. And they went out and went along one street, and immediately the angel departed from him. When Peter came to himself, he said, "Now I know for sure that the Lord has sent forth his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all the Jewish people were expecting." And when he realized this, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, who was also called Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. When he knocked at the door of the gate, a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer. When she recognized Peter's voice, because of her joy, she did not open the gate, but ran in and announced that Peter was standing in front of the gate. They said to her, "You're out of your mind." But she kept insisting that it was so, and they kept saying, "It is his angel." But Peter continued knocking, and when they opened the door, they saw him and were amazed. But motioning them with his hand to be silent, he described to them how the Lord had led him out of prison. And he said, "Report these things to James and the brethren." Then he left and went to another place. And this is the word of God. An article posted May 28th, 2013 in the Huffington Post was about the robocall scandal that shook the last election that we had, where accusations of election fraud were leveled against some who had access to the Federal Conservative Party's database of voter information. She said in the article that it was prompting calls for parties to be held responsible for the use or misuse or loss of the thousands of pieces of information and data that they collect about the average Canadian and about the individual Canadian. Last Thursday, in a ruling overshadowed by the Senate expense scandal with Mike Duffy, federal court judge Richard Mosley found that electoral fraud had occurred in a number of ridings during the 2011 election. The judge pointed the finger at the Conservative Party's database. They called the CIMS, Constituency Information Management System, and said that it was a source of information that was used by somebody to engage in what he called voter suppression tactics, including phone calls to non-conservative voters, those who had indicated that they would not vote for the Conservative Party, telling them that their polling station had been moved. The CIMS contains names, phone numbers, voting intentions, policy decisions on various hot-button issues. And so the robocall case was brought forward by the Council of Canadian Voters on behalf of six ridings where this sort of thing happened and raised questions about the databases and who should be held responsible if they happen to be compromised. I read this and was, again, amazed at what some people will do to gain or to retain political power. They'll lie, they'll cheat, they'll steal. And depending on the place and the time that you live, some will even exhort to murder in order to gain popular support. For example, we read in this chapter this morning, and it begins by talking about King Herod Agrippa I. I want to give you some background on him of what was going on behind the scenes that set him up, because it's important. Herod Agrippa was the grandson of Herod the Great, of Jesus' day fame and the killing of all the babies and so on, and of his wife, who was a Hasmonean named Mariamne. The Hasmonean part is really important. Now, when Agrippa's, they gave birth to Aristobulus, and he married a woman named Bernice, okay, so that's one generation later. And to them was born Agrippa. But what happened was, when Aristobulus was in power, in some sort of power, and when Agrippa was 4 years old, Aristobulus, in true Roman fashion, was executed for some particular reason. And Bernice, his mother, the mother of Agrippa, became fearful and sent him to Rome so that he could be educated and brought up there. He just happened to gain the favor of the Roman emperor and ended up spending his time with some really high-born Roman lads, particularly Claudius and Gaius, who, when they grew up, inherited great power, and then they bestowed enormous power and breadth of power to rule over all of the areas of the Jews on Agrippa, their friend. And Agrippa became more popular with the Jews than any other member of Herod's household ever had, and part of it was because of his bloodline. The Hasmonean dynasty on the in the white there, 165 years before Jesus was born, was responsible for a great Jewish uprising against the Greek Empire that was ruling at the time, and they were famous for that. They were worshipped for that in the sense that the Jews really know their history, and they really appreciate those who know how to rebel well. So King Agrippa came from a Roman family and had managed to garner from a Jewish family and had managed to garner the favor of Roman leadership that he grew up with. And he also had this heroic history in his background that set him up to be well-loved and appreciated and respected all over the places where he ruled. Now, while this was going on in the background of Acts, there was also a change that was taking place that we have more specific detail of, that being the relationship between the Jews and the Christians over time. In Acts 2:47, it says of the Christians that they received favor of all people. All people would include the Jews. But now that we've moved from chapter 2 to chapter 12, the wind is blowing in the exact opposite direction regarding the relationship between the two. And it may have stemmed from the martyrdom of Stephen, the deacon, the church guy, great church leader in Acts chapter 7, by the Jews. And so you've got a change where they were once favored and now they are the enemy. And Agrippa, he was no dummy. He always had his wet finger to the wind to see which way it was blowing, and he sensed this animosity towards the church. And so in order to increase his own popularity, he attacked particularly the leaders of the church, the apostles. So that in chapter 12, verse 2, we read of him putting James the apostle, the brother of John the apostle, to death. So one of the sons of thunder would clap no more. And you could tell that Herod was a political animal, an opportunist, because verse 3 says that when he saw that James' martyrdom pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter, another church leader and apostle as well. And his plan was to, after the Passover, it says to bring Peter out before the people, which is a real cute euphemism for he was planning to bring him out and execute him before the people in order to again gain and retain the popularity that he had with the Jews. While Peter was in prison, despite having four squads of soldiers, we read of something quite remarkable happening in response to the prayer of the church. One of the most famous prison break novels of all time is The Great Escape, starring Steve McQueen. I don't know the last movie he was in, but that was a long time ago. It's based on a true story that deals with the largest Allied escape attempt from a German prisoner of army camp in all of World War II. The first part of the movie focuses on their escape efforts, where they dig tunnels underneath of all of the walls of this prison. And the goofy part is that it was actually the escape-proof prison, according to the Germans. But what they did is they took anyone who had escaped from any other prison and they put them in this prison, so you end up having a gathering spot for the best escape minds of the war. And they broke out in mass through working together to make use of these tunnels. And yet the men who participated in this great escape had nothing over the Apostle Peter, who had a number of remarkable characteristics that happened that they did not have. The first one, first remarkable characteristic of Peter's escape that made it unlikely, is the inescapable extent of his bondage. Four squads of soldiers for one unarmed man, three guarded doors, and being in a cell chained to prison guards before he would have to go through all of those before he could even make it out onto the street. And yet, despite this inescapable extent of his bondage, we also see the unimaginable extent of his peace. That even though it was the night before he was going to be brought before the people and murdered, he was at perfect peace. The text indicates that when the angel appeared in the cell, that he was sound asleep, with two guards bound to him in chains. He could not have had a comfortable position to be asleep, but he was sound asleep despite the impending execution and the uncomfortable position. He was in REM sleep. So deep, in fact, that when the angel came, it says that it shone and it lit up the cell, which should have woken him with that. But the text says that the angel actually had to strike him on the side to wake him up. He had to kick him in the ribs to get him going. And there's something about those who walk closely with God that eliminates or at least reduces the fear of death and replaces it with a remarkable peace. I recall reading one of the biographies of Dietrich Bonhoeffer called Till the Night Be Past. Implicated in a failed plot to assassinate Hitler, Bonhoeffer was sentenced to die by hanging. And the prison surgeon recorded what happened that night. Part of it reading, "Through the half-open door in one room, I saw Pastor Bonhoeffer, before taking off his prison garb, kneeling on the floor and fervently praying to his God. I was most deeply moved by the way that this loved man prayed, so devout, so certain that God heard his prayer. At the place of execution, he again said a short prayer and then climbed the steps to the gallows. Brave, composed, his death followed in seconds. How could he do this? When I read this account, I was reminded of Isaiah's song of God's protection in Psalm 26, verse 3, which is best heard in the King James, actually, where Isaiah says to God, "Thou wilt keep him in perfect peace, whose heart is stayed or rested on thee, because he trusts in thee." And in perfect peace, Bonhoeffer climbed the gallows steps. In perfect peace, Peter slept, knowing that he would certainly die the next day. But then in the verses that follow, in verses 7 and following, we see the third characteristic of his escape, which is a supernatural intervention from God. A remarkable rescue by an angel, where chains fall off, where he and Peter go through two guarded doors, and then the gates, the front gates, actually swing open so that they can walk out in kind of get smart fashion. If you've seen the movie or the shows where the gates just kind of open and he works his way through. Leaving the prison, Peter and the angel walk a couple of streets together, just probably the sounds of cats in the garbage and maybe a dog or so barking to disturb the peace, and then the angel left him. Now, what would you do if you'd just been sprung from jail the night before you were to be executed for the enjoyment of the crowd that was gathered in the place you were being detained? Personally, I would get as far away as possible from those intending to execute me and the audience who would enjoy it. I would dump my cell phone in the garbage lest I be traced. And then I would flee the city quickly and quietly to a place as far away from civilization as I could get, probably Saskatchewan. Before the sun came up, because the purpose of the remaining distance before the sun came up, the remaining time, was to put as much distance between you and them as you possibly could. But instead, verses 11 and 12 said, when Peter came to himself, in other words, when he dawned on him what had happened, he said, "Now I know for sure that the Lord had sent forth his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all the Jewish people were expecting. And when he realized this, he did what I would never do. He went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, who was also called Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying." Where common sense would say to flee, Peter does something most curious, and I would add most dangerous. He goes to the house of Mary. Now, if you've read the Gospels and the book of Acts, you know, man, there are a lot of Marys in the New Testament. This was Mary, the mother of John Mark, who eventually became one of the traveling people who went with the apostles. And by now, the church was probably large enough that it could not meet in a single building and would have not been allowed to meet at the synagogue either. But Mary's house must have been one of the larger ones. She and her probably Roman husband, because of the John, Jewish, Mark, Greek, or Roman combination, they'd probably done very well in business or something and must have had quite a house. Martin Hingel, in his book Between Jesus and Paul, called her house a splendid one. One of the reasons being that there was a gatehouse leading from the courtyard to the street door. For comparison's sake, if you read of Jesus' trial in Matthew 26 and Peter being involved in that and the description of the high priest's house, they're very similar in terms of their size. So she had a monster house. And rather than fleeing for his life, Peter heads there to visit the church that he expected had been or were praying for him. Perhaps he wanted to surprise them, to encourage them, to inform them that they could stop praying now because he had been released. Personally, I would have sent a singing telegram or something. Let them know that somehow that the Agrippa was going to blow his stack in the morning when he found out that Paul was missing, and they would do best to hide. Instead, he knocks on the gate. And verse 13 contains an ironic response to his knock, because it says that a sweet servant girl named Rhoda recognized his voice outside the gate. Peter probably saying something like, "Rhoda, it's me, Peter, hurry up, let me in, they'll be looking for me soon." But the passage says that because of joy, not a person but an emotion, she didn't open the gate but ran and announced that Peter was standing outside the gate. The irony of the verse being that the gates of the prison that should not have opened up swung open, and the gates of the house that should have swung open remained locked. Now, it's important for us to know and to focus a little bit on what was going on behind those locked doors. Verse 12 says that many were gathered to pray, presumably for Peter, I'm sure. It may have been a normal prayer meeting night for them, but Peter would have had his name on the list, especially after someone else like James and Stephen had already been martyred. So his name was probably at the top of the list while they prayed. In verse 5, Luke gives even more detail to the nature of the prayer that was going up, where he says that prayer for Peter was being made fervently by the church of God. So it confirms that Peter was on the list, and it says that it was being offered up in a manner that Luke refers to as fervently. It can be translated earnestly, but it literally means stretched out, okay? Which is the same word, when you realize it's interesting, because Luke wrote Acts and Luke wrote Luke. And he used the same word, fervently, that he uses to describe the church's prayer here, as he did when he talked about Jesus praying to his Father in the Garden of Gethsemane. That kind of intensity. It's when one's hands are stretched out and the word carries with it this wholehearted, passionate pleading to God. An English preacher named Samuel Chadwick, in a book that he wrote, The Power of Prayer, wrote this. I thought it was profound and poetic at the same time. Intensity is the law of prayer. There are blessings of the kingdom that are only yielded to the violence of the vehement soul. The violence of the vehement soul. And he goes on to give several examples of what he's talking about. Abraham pleading for Sodom. Jacob wrestling in the stillness of the night. Moses standing in the breach. Hannah intoxicated with sorrow. And David brokenhearted with remorse and grief. And it was that kind of prayer, that kind of intensity that was going on in Mary's house. God, save Peter's life. Spare him, we beg you. Use your power to set him free. And then the most annoying thing happens as they are crying out to God. An excited servant girl runs into the prayer meeting, probably in the middle of all of them praying together, and she announces, verse 14, that Peter, about whom they are praying, has been set free and is standing outside the gate. Now, how annoying is that, right? You're pouring out all of this energy. You're crying out to God, knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door, and the answer to your prayer is standing outside the gate. But how annoying to be told that. Like, stop interrupting our prayers with answers to our prayers because we're here praying. Their response to the answer of fervent prayer is unbelievable. Unbelievably bad. Verse 15, they said to her, "You're out of your mind. Like, you're crazy." Isn't that the most bizarre response? It'd be like buying a ticket for the Foothills Hospital Cash and Cars Lottery. Now, on the draw date, you get a phone call from the man who claims to be the CEO or CFO, whatever, of that organization. "This is so-and-so calling from the Cash and Cars Lottery. I'm calling to let you know that you have just won a brand new Porsche. Congratulations. The car is waiting for you at the Porsche Center, Calgary. Just show up with some ID, with your ticket, and make sure you tithe on the winnings." And you respond, "You know what? I don't believe you. I think you're crazy and just trying to fool me," and click. Like, who would do that without at least checking? Well, that's basically what the prayer meeting attendees did to Rhoda, who was obviously in her right mind the rest of the night. Crazy just then. Finally, they believe her. Well, they partially believe her, that someone who resembles Peter is standing outside the gate, but they questioned her interpretation of who it was, repeatedly labeling the visitor as Peter's angel in verse 17. Now, as an aside, this gives us just a little crack to look through pertaining to the Jewish understanding of guardian angels. Even Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew, when he encouraged people not to look down on little ones, said that their angels in heaven always see the face of my Father. It's not a full-blown theology on guardian angels, but it gives you an idea of what could have been going on in the minds of those Jews who were praying there, or Christians. In this case, those in the prayer meeting were more inclined to believe that God would send Peter's guardian angel to them than that he would release Peter to see them, which is really kooky when you think about the logic of it. If God was going to send Peter's guardian angel to anyone, it would be to the one over whom he is the guardian, which would be Peter. So that may have well been a guardian angel that kicked him in the ribs. Angel nonetheless, right? And if he was going to send someone resembling Peter as an answer to their prayers to encourage their faith, it would be Peter, not his angel. And what all of this reveals to us, when you see the way they excused and wrote off an answer to these fervent prayers, is that it's possible for us to pray with intensity and fervency. It's possible for us to say all of the right words and yet secretly doubt that God hears, can, or will answer. I think that was the case here. It had to be, or they wouldn't have acted that way. Let me explain why this might have been the case here. The Apostle James, listed in verse 2, was one of the vital church leaders. Therefore, we can be confident that when he was arrested, especially after Stephen had been martyred, that they prayed their hearts out that God would deliver James, bring him back safe, keep him from death. They prayed fervently for him with outstretched arms. They prayed to God, who in his sovereignty answered their prayer and said, "No." And one of their beloved apostles, who had actually spent time with Jesus and could tell them stories directly about him, was martyred. Now, they passionately pray for Peter. And it's not like their prayers lack intensity. It's not like they lack the right words. Rather, their response to God actually answering their prayer reveals doubt that they believed that God could or would come through. Like putting everything you've got into a golf swing, knowing that you are going to slice despite all of your concerted effort, and when the ball goes straight, you marvel. These Christians went through all of the vigorous motions and said all of the words with intensity and outstretched arms. But they had a recent identical prayer in the back of their minds in which God did not come through, and it caused them to secretly doubt that he would come through this time. So much so that they denied the answer to the prayer, and then they tried to explain it away. You know, you'll find nowhere in Scripture where doubt is affirmed as good. What you will find is plenty of examples that it happens sometimes. Not because we want to doubt, but because faith is not a static thing. It is a dynamic thing that moves and shifts. And we also have plenty of examples of God's gracious actions and answers to prayer in the face of doubts. In some of these times, God will surprise you with a gracious answer anyway, which he did to that church, which ought to give you hope today that when your faith might go up and down like a crop duster plane, God will still sometimes in his grace surprise us despite us. So keep crying out though you have no experience of an answer. Keep crying out though evidence would suggest that he will not act. Keep crying out with everything you have in you, even though it is meager, because you never know when God will surprise you with a gracious answer to what you would have to admit is very feeble faith. The prayer of a person shaken from certainty by tragedy, by God not healing when you asked, not providing what you wanted, not delivering from tough circumstances. Well, the Gospel of Mark tells a story of a man with a demon-possessed son who cried out to Jesus and said, "If you can do anything, have pity on us and help us." And Jesus responded by saying, "If you can do anything, all things are possible to him who believes." And the man, knowing that his faith was fluttering but that his need was great, said what we might have to say often, maybe this morning, what seems like a contradiction but is not: "I do believe, but help my unbelief." They go together sometimes. And Jesus, rather than judging his incomplete faith, acts graciously in response to that paltry faith and delivers the boy from the demon as a gift to this man. And perhaps this is where you're standing today, believing and fighting doubts because things have not worked out in the past and you're there again. Similar circumstances where God did not come through before, where he hasn't come through for a long time. And all that you can do is reach out with the faith and trust that he will graciously answer according to his sovereign plan and his goodness. During our prayer time, we're going to have people at the front who will pray for you and with you, who will believe for you and with you. And the invitation is open for you to pray to God for that thing, that person, that situation that you secretly doubt he will give you, or he will answer, or he will address. The opportunity will be here to have someone pray with you and to give God the opportunity to surprise you with his grace today, like he did those who gathered in Mary's house so many years ago. Why don't you come as we sing together?